morning. Please be seated. The first case on our docket this morning is Brian Lee Hall v. the State of Nevada, case number 62663. Ready to go, counsel?
Yes,
sir. Ms. Felicia, how are you?
Chief Justice Hardesty, Justices, Counsel for the State, my name is Amy Feliciano from the Clark County Public Defender's Office, and I represent Brian Hall. I ask this court at this time to reserve 7 minutes for rebuttal. Unless this court has a direction in which it would like me to proceed, I will first address the trial errors and then move to the penalty phase errors. Before I begin to argue the claims of error, I'm going to reiterate that the fundamental and longstanding axiom that I know this court is very familiar with, that death is different. The first error that I'm going to argue at the trial phase was that Mr. Hall was prejudicially precluded from introducing character evidence regarding Mr. Flam and statements that he would make. Hall's defense theory was that Flam provoked Hall and that Hall, therefore, committed voluntary manslaughter. Thus, critical to Hall's defense at trial was whether Flam committed provocation through inflammatory and derogatory remarks. A criminal defendant has the right to present his defense, which includes the right to present character evidence and or habit and custom evidence to support his theory. A denial of such can arise to a constitutional violation of due process and a fundamentally fair trial. Generally, character evidence is inadmissible to show that a person acted in conformity therewith unless a criminal defendant offers character evidence or habit and custom evidence of the victim. And under Petty versus State, character evidence of the victim is admissible when offered by a criminal defendant.
What would you have put in evidence on that?
On this issue, that Hall attempted to have Laura Jones testify about his character and habit, that he was the kind of person who would make smart aleck remarks that would lead to this provocation. Hall made a proffer regarding this, that Jones would testify that Hall and Paulson's should not procreate. The state relies on a conversation that it had with Paulson with Jones, where she said that she did not hear that statement. That, in fact, was, and the state said that it was an improper hypothetical without any relevance. Hall was permitted to ask Jones whether Flam was a person who would make a comment like that under both character evidence and habit and custom evidence. But the district court excluded that and denied his request to present that.
Wasn't there other testimony presented that was similar? There was some testimony presented, I believe, on cross-examination by, Coy, C-O-I-E?
Yes, by Ms. Coy. The defense asked, Hall asked, if Flam said inappropriate things.
Correct. Isn't that a similar type of testimony that you were seeking to have admitted?
It's similar to it, but it is not the same as what Hall was asking Ms. Jones to testify to.
What specifically was the distinction?
The distinction was that Coy described that he would say inappropriate things.
Mm-hmm.
That Hall was going to present that Jones would testify specifically that he would make smart aleck remarks, that it was his habit, his custom, not out of his character. And because the defense theory was that Flam made these inflammatory remarks regarding Flam's previous relationship with Ms. Paulson and challenging his paternity, that this could lead to sufficient provocation. So the fact that the defense was able to get this information from Ms. Coy does not provide him with constitutional right to present the defense regarding the specific statements as it goes to character evidence and habit and custom.
Counsel, in light of the other evidence that was introduced as to some of those statements, what was the prejudice?
The statements were introduced through Mr. Hall, and there was nothing to support that those statements or that Mr. Flam would have made those type of statements. Based on the defense theory that Mr. Flam engaged Mr. Hall in provocative, inflammatory remarks, without more, this gutted the defense theory and did not give Hall the right to present a complete defense in support of the voluntary manslaughter argument.
Now, did the trial attorney then try to put that type of evidence in the penalty phase and use it as a mitigation?
Not as far as I know, Your Honor.
Why not? Whereas if at first you don't succeed, try again, and at least it could have been a mitigation that that the victim had something to do with the encounter, and certainly it could be the jury could use that as mitigation. I'm surprised somebody didn't try to do it the second time.
As far as I was not the trial attorney, but I would suspect that the reason is because of the district court's order precluding that information coming out during the trial phase, that Hall was operating under that order and assumed that it was then inadmissible.
Counsel, you talk about this alleged rape situation from Mr. Hall, but the way this seems to lay out in terms of we have this killing, we have multiple stages of strangulation, choking, knifing, blunt force trauma, leaving, coming back. How do those alleged comments fit into this? Because we have this time period.
We do have a time period, Your Honor. And the time period shows, and Mr. Hall testified, that even though this went on for approximately 25 minutes and there were multiple acts that occurred, that he was still under the provocation of the inflammatory statements that Mr. Flam made to him. And I would analogize this to a situation of a victim making an excited utterance or a witness making an excited utterance. This court has held, with regard to excited utterances, that the stress of the event can occur even a day later and can continue on.
Knowing that the party is dead, going away, picking up stones or an object and coming back and bludgeoning, that's you're comparing that with an excited utterance situation?
Mr. Hall testified, yes I am. Mr. Hall testified that he was still under the provocation of Mr. Flam's statements and therefore still acting under the provocation, and therefore, there's no time period to say when the provocation should end. His testimony was that he was still under that, and so the actions that he did were all designed to kill Mr. Flam. I'll move next to that Hall was erroneously precluded from introducing Flam's drug use in violation of due process and the right to present a defense. Again, an accused has a right to present a defense at trial and confront and cross-examine the witnesses against him. During the testimony of the medical examiner, the medical examiner testified regarding the cause of Flam's death. The medical examiner's findings also included Flam's toxicology screen, which found that Flam had narcotics in his system. Now, the state argued that Hall was just trying to get the levels in and not the effects, and the state offered then to stipulate to admission of the report. However, the state said that information regarding the effects of the toxicology screen was irrelevant and had no bearing on Hall's defense theory. The district court found with the state and did not allow this evidence. The report was ultimately admitted as a defense exhibit. However, the jury was not provided with any explanation as to the significance of the narcotics in Mr. Flam's system.
Was there an expert that was ready, willing, and able to testify as to what perhaps the effect would have been?
There was no specific toxicology expert, but medical examiners are trained medical professionals. Whenever there is an autopsy conducted, a toxicology screen is prepared along with it. Medical examiners then take a look at the toxicology screen and make a determination whether any presence of an illicit substance or any type of substance would contribute to cause of death. So a medical examiner is certainly a qualified expert to testify regarding the effects of any substances.
Didn't the medical examiner, who determined what the cause of death was?
The medical examiner determined the cause of death.
And what was that determination?
That it was blunt force trauma and the stabbing to the throat.
And there was no implication as to any narcotic being involved?
No. Okay. But the defense still attempted to examine the medical examiner regarding the effects of the presence of narcotics in Mr. Flam's system, consistent with Hall's defense theory that Mr. Flam would have been disinhibited by the influence of the narcotic, and therefore...
And that testimony you were going to get in through the medical examiner?
That's correct.
And was there an offer of proof?
There was an offer of proof made regarding this. And there was a proffer made about when Hall attempted to cross-examine the medical examiner. When the state objected on the grounds of relevance, the district court sustained the objection, and Hall had previously made an extensive proffer regarding the evidence's significance.
I don't want to sound like a broken record, but then did the trial attorney try to put this in the penalty phase? Recalling the medical examiner to talk about the effects of narcotics on a victim?
No, the trial attorney did not. However, did argue about the toxicology in closing argument of the trial phase, but was not able to get into the significance of it because it was not testified to as to the significance of the narcotics in Mr. Flem's.
Was any case law cited by either side to either support that it wasn't relevant or to say that it was relevant? Any law?
Not to my recollection, Your Honor.
Any argument? Any briefs filed?
I'm sorry?
Was there any briefs filed?
No, there were no pretrial briefs filed on this issue, and Hall's attorney argued that it would be, you know, due process right to present a defense in a fundamentally fair trial.
Do you have the page and site for the offer of proof that you answered Justice Hardesty's question about? Because in your reply brief, you acknowledge, and I appreciate the candor, that indeed there was evidence of the hydrocodone usage.
Correct.
I thought you were walking away from that issue altogether, but now you're making a different argument. So could you give me the offer of proof?
That's correct. I believe that the offer of proof is made in Volume 9, page 1864, and then 1865 through 79 is the discussion on the offer of proof and the toxicology report.
Thank you.
Yes. And just to distinguish the position in the reply brief, the issue was not whether this was admitted as a piece of evidence, but rather whether it was able to be explained to the jury what the significance was.
I understand the distinction. I didn't understand that in the reply brief.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Next, I will move to the state's failure to present sufficient evidence at the trial to support the first-degree murder conviction. When the state fails to present sufficient evidence at trial such that a reasonable jury could not have been convinced about the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, the defendant's conviction must be vacated as it violates due process. On appellate review, of course, this court must focus on whether the evidence at trial was sufficient to justify a rational trier of fact to find guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Hall has raised three separate issues. I will address the first, which is that the state failed to prove that first-degree murder was committed by premeditation and deliberation. When a homicide occurs after a serious and highly provoking injury that would excite an irresistible passion in a reasonable person, the defendant is guilty of voluntary manslaughter and not first-degree murder, and that was Hall's defense theory. A provoking injury need not be a physical battery or direct contact for voluntary manslaughter purposes, but words alone can be enough. Now here, Hall admitted to killing Flam. However, he testified that the attack occurred after Flam confronted Hall with his previous sexual relationship with Paulson, and after Flam questioned Hall's paternity of Hall and Paulson's child. Hall testified that he was so enraged he attacked Flam, ultimately resulting in Flam's death. Furthermore, Hall was intoxicated and suffered an irresistible passion in attacking Mr. Flam. Now, the state argued that because Hall slammed Flam's head into the concrete, stabbed his neck, hit him with a river rock, that this shows premeditation and deliberation. And just as I answered Justice Douglas's question regarding the time period, I would submit again that he was the entire time under this irresistible passion, and that this supports Mr. Hall's voluntary manslaughter theory. The testimony was also that prior to the instant incident, nothing in the record supported that there was any discord between Hall and Flam. The state did not present any evidence to contradict Hall's testimony that there was no provocation, and therefore the state failed to prove premeditation deliberation.
But isn't that really a jury question? I mean, why should we second-guess the jury on the issue of premeditation? It could be formed in the blink of an eyelash, eyebrows, they say.
Mm-hmm. And I understand, although yes, it is a jury question, this court is on appellate review, determines whether a rational jury could have found premeditation deliberation based on the evidence. Because the state, who bears the burden, provided no evidence to contradict Hall's testimony that this occurred under irresistible passion, there was no evidence beyond a reasonable doubt.
Counsel, is the jury allowed to look at the circumstances that are adduced as to what occurred in terms of Hall going back to that location, meeting him in a walkway, shirt allegedly off, the confrontation and going and coming? Can they consider all that, the miscellaneous facts, and come up with their own?
Yes, Your Honor, they can consider circumstantial evidence, but the circumstantial evidence in this case and the actions that Mr. Hall committed still support that he was acting under the irresistible passion of the event. The fact that he came back later does not support that it was premeditation and deliberation.
But isn't the jury free to accept what they wish to accept from the testimony provided by Mr. Hall, as well as look at the other circumstantial evidence and make their decision?
That is correct. The jury is able to do that, but in this case, based on the evidence that was presented and the state's failure to contradict any evidence, no rational trier of fact.
Must the state contradict, or must the state merely present and the jury makes a determination as to the weight to be given?
Well, once Mr. Hall has raised the issue that he was under the passion of the event, the irresistible passion, and there is nothing else presented by the state to support that, the state does have a responsibility.
Is a reasonable juror mandated to accept that as being true, or they can consider it?
They can consider the testimony, but ultimately the state bears the burden of proving premeditation deliberation beyond a reasonable doubt. And thus, the state had a duty in order to prove premeditation deliberation to provide evidence of that. And in this case, there was no evidence presented, and thus a rational trier of fact could not have found premeditation and deliberation under these circumstances.
Well, I would query you if it's reasonable doubt or all doubt.
Well, it's the standard obviously is beyond a reasonable doubt, and the state bears that burden. And there was nothing here to support that the state presented anything to support premeditation and deliberation.
The jury had entirely within its power to determine the credibility of what was presented. You don't disagree with that. So they could have discounted entirely theory that it was committed under this passion and rage,
and that's correct. But
they saw the entire proceedings. They evaluated all the testimony that was presented, and it was within their province to gauge the credibility.
And that is correct, Your Honor. But I would submit that based on, again, going back to the state, there's the burden, and to say that somehow, even if they did not accept Mr. Hall's testimony as being credible, the state presented nothing to show that this was premeditation and deliberation. And the state bears the burden of proving this beyond a reasonable doubt. So under those circumstances, even if the jury found Mr. Hall, his testimony not credible, because of the lack of evidence on the state's part, no rational jury could have found that there was premeditation and deliberation.
Was the jury instructed on second degree and voluntary manslaughter?
Yes, Your Honor.
And was it argued in the final argument by defense attorney that that there was no premeditation and that this was at most voluntary manslaughter? Or if you don't believe that, how about second degree murder?
Yes, Your Honor.
So it was argued?
Yes, yes, the voluntary manslaughter.
Could you address for me before you sit down, and this is switching subjects, the penalty hearing and the evidence that was admitted from your client's juvenile incarceration, specifically the psychiatric or psychological or social worker evaluations of his future dangerousness, and analyzed the Redmond Green issue associated with that?
Yes, Your Honor, and that was, I believe, a very important aspect to the penalty hearing that was improper. During the capital phase of the, during the capital penalty phase, after a finding of first-degree murder, the state may introduce evidence of future dangerousness. However, under Green and Redmond, psychiatric evidence regarding dangerousness is highly unreliable and inadmissible and improper for purposes of the penalty phase. However, the state then introduced psychiatric evaluations prepared nearly 14 years earlier for a juvenile proceeding for Mr. Hall.
And that's different from Redmond and Green, correct? In Redmond and Green, the reports were prepared for the penalty hearing, right?
That's correct, but I would say...
Is that a distinction without a difference, or does it make a difference to the reliability of the evidence?
I would say it is not a distinction without a difference. It does make a difference regarding the reliability of the evidence, and I would submit that it is far more improper to introduce the juvenile psychiatric records regarding future dangerousness.
Why?
First of all, the juvenile records that were introduced in this case stated that they were confidential and that they were prepared purely for whether Mr. Hall was eligible for parole as a juvenile. They were also prepared 14 years prior to him going through this penalty phase. If we're going to say that psychiatric evidence of an adult at the time that the offense was committed is improper, then it should be far more improper to introduce and far more irrelevant to introduce, therefore, juvenile psychiatric evaluations that, number one, as I said, were confidential, prepared solely for parole determination regarding the juvenile conviction. And a juvenile is not instructed when they submit, and Mr. Hall was not instructed, that this could then apply, say, some 14 years later, and to show that he has future dangerousness in a capital penalty phase.
Let's say I agreed with you. Was there harm to him given the violent history that he had as an adult?
The violent history that he had as an adult was, I would submit, not as egregious as what was presented by the psychological evaluations. The psychological evaluations, they described him as being, you know, of a certain antisocial nature, that he was incredibly dangerous. It was his adult convictions, the battery with substantial bodily harm. May I continue? Thank you. The battery with substantial bodily harm was, in comparison to the juvenile entries, I don't want to say nothing, but the juvenile psychiatric records reference far more egregious conduct.
So we're talking about shades of egregious information put before the jury. If we were to, as Justice Pickering suggests, eliminate or find error in the admission of the juvenile records, you're suggesting that that which was presented in his adult or by his adult record would have paled in comparison and the jury might not have seen future dangerousness in this individual?
I would
agree. Threatened a pregnant woman, repeatedly violated certain protection orders, sort of sounds dangerous to me.
And I agree, I cannot speculate as to what the jury would have done, but I can say that in comparison to the psychiatric and the four psychiatric evaluations that were admitted from when he was a juvenile, that the jury may not have found that
But you conceded that they could have been redacted to omit the opinion testimony or opinion evidence of the people who saw him when he was a juvenile, that the facts of what he did would still be before the jury?
I would submit, Your Honor, that the facts of what he did in his juvenile proceeding should not have been presented to the jury. And this is an issue I know the court has been dealing with through the Brian Clay case, and as I said, I submit that juvenile offenses, because...
But that's a separate issue from this Redmond Green issue.
That is a separate issue, but I believe that it dovetails onto this.
Yeah. If I might, I want to go back to where you were just a second. I don't want to bleed into your time too much. We talked about the testimony of the continuing provocation that your client claims he acted under. But by his own testimony, he said that at least part of the attack on Mr. Flynn in this case took place when he realized that he had changed the course of his own life. And he went back because he was essentially angry at what he had done. Isn't that a split in that provocation that Mr. Flynn may have caused? And then now all of a sudden we have him going back with clear intent to do further harm to the victim?
I would submit that no, he is still under the provocation, whether he recognizes what he has done or not, that he was still acting under Mr. Flynn's provocation and any intent to go back. He was still under the irresistible passion of what had occurred.
Ms. Feliciano, in the coroner's testimony, and I didn't have a chance to check this, did the coroner attribute the final cause of death to the blow inflicted after he returned with the rock, or was the opinion that Flam was already deceased before that blow was inflicted?
As far as my recollection, Your Honor, and I don't mean to misstate the testimony, that's it, but as far as my recollection, there was no finding regarding time or sequential events. The finding would have been made just the factors that occurred to cause the death.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
You'll have, I'll give you another minute on the rebuttal.
Thank you.
Morning, Mr. Stanton.
Good morning, Justice Harvey, excuse me. Ladies and gentlemen, David Stanton on behalf of the state. Justice Pickering, if I can answer or at least address the issue that you raised about the psychological records and the assessment of Redmond and Green as it relates to this case. I would respectfully submit that a close examination of this record will find as an undisputable fact is that none of the records claim, state, or infer directly what appellant now claims before this court about a finding of future dangerousness. Mr. Hall was incarcerated in a juvenile facility, and he was denied parole, as the records show, because of his behavior in the facility. Total lack of an attempt to rehabilitate, counsel, do all the things that are clearly and demonstrably exhibited through the records. As he's aging out, because they don't parole him, the mandatory assessments of what he represents or how they assess them psychologically occurs. And let me quote at page 3270 of the opinion of the appellate record of Dr. Deborah Leong, L-E-O-N-G, which states, quote, and this is one of the two quotes that the appellant makes to this court that were evidence of future dangerousness. And quoting again from Dr. Leong, he does not present clear and current evidence of dangerousness at this time, close quote. And you'll find in the other citation that they make to another doctor's and how the state ultimately argued it was, once again, not a finding of future dangerousness. The assessment was that he was a sexual sadist and that there was a opinion of this doctor that counseling and treatment and taking his condition and his behavior towards victims to be a serious matter and not to deflect it as he was doing while he was incarcerated. At no time will you find any of the records that state he is a future danger. It is more in the lines of this is what he needs to do so that he can be a productive member of society. And that's how it was argued.
Mr. Stanton, counsel for Mr. Hall began with bringing to our attention what she considered the error. That was the refusal to allow Hall to introduce character evidence. And in essence, based upon that, he should be given a new trial. This should be thrown out. What is your basic response to this position about not allowing them to present their theory of the case?
Well, I'm kind of a trial lawyer, so my first thing is to go to the facts as opposed to the appellate standard that you all to apply. So if you indulge me going back to the kind of the core of that. Number one, the decision or the issue of admitting character evidence in this case, as it is argued, is a rule of evidence. And I just ask the court to kind of view, if you're considering that somehow this was a violation of that rule of evidence, how that rule of evidence is going to apply on both the behalf of the state and the inverse and criminal defendants. In this particular case, what they had as evidence, both from Marita Coes, I believe the way she pronounced her name, that is the victim's fiance who was working with him at Trevi's that night as a fellow waitstaff. She indicated that he had, and that was what was admitted from the jury, from the victim's own fiance, on occasion would say, in public settings, something inappropriate. But, Justice, there was nothing further than that. There was nothing further about what that inappropriate conduct was. And that's where the state has a problem with applying that as a rule of evidence that was violated by the district court. It is something completely distinctive when you have either from a deceased victim in a murder case or from a defendant where you have evidence of prior acts that are consistent with their behavior that's proffered in front of the jury, such as a crime or act of violence, past acts that would indicate who is the initial aggressor. Here you have a very broad statement of that character trait, and yet they're now claiming that trait is supportive of him making statements that on its face are unbelievable. And as the comments I'll address in just short order about the facts were completely rejected by the jury because it was inconsistent with the character of the victim. So to me, the evidence was precisely what the attempt to admit the evidence was violates precisely what the law prevents, and more highlighted in a case where someone, the murder victim who's deceased, you're assassinating somebody's character, not pursuant to the rules of evidence. If you had a specific instance or character trait more narrow to what the defense was proffering, that is a statement about, and it was very vulgar, the appellate briefs don't cite to the direct statement that was the most, if believed, offensive, that he had sex or his sexual, I'm cleaning this up as best I can, was so great with the defendant's then wife, that, and he was the one that had it, that she had twins. Very graphic, very crude statements. If you had evidence of the victim's character making something even remotely close to that in a social setting, I would agree that that would be more relevant than the broad statement that he would say something inappropriate. What is it, an inappropriate joke? And that's the problem I have, that, and I don't think the district court violated, in saying you haven't come close enough to offering something that is admissible under the rules of evidence.
Now, I haven't been in the trenches for almost 20 years, but I thought in that situation that you have to do reputation in the community before you can get to any specific acts. Did the defense try to do that at all? It doesn't sound like they did it correctly. I thought you were right in saying maybe that the area of law that was brought up about character evidence was not followed like it should be, where you put on an evidence of reputation in the community, and then you get maybe specific acts and also what the defendant knew or, and when he knew it, didn't know it, that thing.
And I agree, Justice Stanton.
No, I agree, Justice Cherry, and the thing is the reputation in the community as to what? Inappropriate comments I don't think has ever been upheld by any court, state or federal, as a basis of a character flaw that's admissible pursuant to a set of circumstances of actual comments or specific subject matter down the road by either another witness or whatever. It's way too broad, and it's not character evidence of anything.
They didn't try to put in a reputation of non-peacefulness of the victim?
Correct. And then yet there was evidence here both by his fiancée and co-workers that indeed the defendant
was not that type of person at all. He had, didn't have any enemies, wasn't controversial. So whatever his... Whatever his comments were, they were not of the nature that would then cause people to dislike him or to get into physical confrontations, which was exactly the state's objection in this case, both to, and in all cases, to bring in the tox results of the murder victim at trial. And to answer your question, Justice Hardy, and I think one of the other justices' questions about cause and manner of death, the consumption, which were prescription medications within therapeutic levels, number one, couldn't be determined that the defendant was under the influence of them. I mean, he had them in the system, but that's a distinction between that it affected his state of mind and reasoning. No evidence was proffered by that, either on the record or outside the jury's presence or in some attempt to admit that.
Well, what was the offer of proof in that regard? There was an indication that there was an offer of proof made.
Yes, there was. The offer of proof. Attempted two ways. Number one, through a witness who was asked to testify to two things. This was a co-worker of both the victim and his fiance, and that was this statement about made allegedly by the victim that the defendant and his wife, girlfriend at the time of the murder, should not have procreated. The problem with that is the witness testified outside the jury's presence. She was never a percipient witness to the statement, so as a foundational basis, she couldn't properly testify to that.
What did this have to do with the narcotics? I'm going back to the narcotics.
Oh, to the narcotics?
Yes.
Nothing, because there was no witness that had any knowledge of that, that testified at trial about his use of narcotics or how he behaved under the influence of narcotics.
No, counsel suggested that there was an offer of proof as to what the coroner would say, and I think that's what Justice Perrigari is getting at.
You know,
I don't know whether you recall that or not.
I do recall now the argument, and I apologize, Justice Perrigari, not including to your comment. Counsel cited to the appellate record. I don't recall that there being an offer of proof, and I would just, and let's just assume that there was. The pathologist, and then pathologists in all cases, can generally testify to what they know about what's in someone's systems, but they certainly can't testify as to what effect that had on this particular person, both either by the levels or by the type of narcotic it was. And in this particular case, it wasn't, and as counsel said in the proffer, it had no determination of the cause and manner of death in this case, which is really all that a forensic pathologist can say, other than their general knowledge as a licensed physician as to what they know of an effect of a drug. In fact, most defendants call experts, which wasn't, to answer Justice Cherry's earlier question, presented even in the penalty phase, about what effect that type of Lortabs in this particular case would have had on people in general, and they certainly couldn't have testified as to how it affected this particular person. There's just a couple other things that I'd like to highlight as to the totality of circumstances. One is a very subtle thing.
Well, before you move away from the discussion about the juvenile records, you've commented about the Redmond and Green question, but what about this court's consideration or review of the introduction of juvenile records at all in these proceedings?
Well,
I don't know that that's really very well posted up in this appeal, but that said, it is of a concern.
Yeah, I agree with you, Chief Justice, that it is not part of this. I would note a couple things. Number one is Green and Redmond State. Green was... and I agree with the court's finding because I am a firm believer that psychiatry and psychology cannot, under any circumstances, predict future behavior. And the Nevada Supreme Court in Green cautioned and sent the message that indeed it is not a science and therefore it is inadmissible evidence. But Green's, the facts was that Dr. Consora had testified that the defendant was a thrill seeker. And then from that, the prosecution argued that there was future dangerousness. Now, number one, there's a very weak nexus between that testimony and making that argument and Green itself. In this particular case, as I said before, there was no finding at any point in the records saying that the defendant was a future danger to the community. It does say that he, if not treated, if he doesn't pursue it seriously, that his problems are going to continue, and obviously from that you can infer he could be a danger to others down the road. As far as the juvenile records, Chief Justice, I would simply state that in cases such as this, the relevance of what was occurring with the, and I think your question is both to the psychiatric records as to the, also as to the records about the underlying behavior that he exhibited that was quite...
Actually, the latter as much as anything.
Okay.
I mean, if I accept your representation as to the characterization to be given the opinions that are contained in those records, then I'm looking more at the latter than the former.
And don't, look, there's certainly an inference someone can draw by that, but there's certainly nothing that says, look, if he's released, you know, lock all your doors or some, or something even remotely we've seen in psychiatric records to that regard. As far as the underlying facts, I don't think the records should be treated any differently in that regard as it would be if they were police reports, if they were descriptions through an investigation that found it that never approached recordation either by a facility or by a law enforcement agency.
I sense that 14 years is a bit remote for me, especially when you're examining juvenile behavior. I'm a little bit concerned about how much one gets to tack back that far.
A great question. And how about when you tack back that far, if it's relevant to the proceedings that you have, not only in the sense of the gravity of a capital sentencing phase, but when it tracks to the facts and circumstances of what you're dealing with. Mm. And that, I think, Judge, would make the relevance of it. To be fair to the state, when you're characterizing who the individual is standing before that jury when they make such a monumentous decision as they did in this case, I think that nexus and the commonality between that violent sexual behavior and what I believe was the true motive in this case. And that's what I think is the very subtle aspect of this case. If I could briefly tell you the framework of this. What was compelling to the state, Mr. Turner and myself, when we tried this case, and what was a major factor when this case was argued to the jury, is exactly what's argued to you in the gravamen of their brief of the underlying facts of this case. Why? What's the motive? We attempted in the pretrial hearing to admit an event where the defendant, while drunk, same circumstances, with his then five-month pregnant wife, beat her severely in front of his own mother. And the motive there was that he wanted to kill, Mr. Hall wanted to kill every single person that his wife had ever had been sexually intimate in the past. Not only had he did it that day while he was beating her, but he had made those threats in the past. And that is, it's found on page 2380 and 2381, volume 9. Compelling statement from his then wife, now divorced from the defendant, and not only did he want to kill him, he then tells his wife that he wants to watch her kill her prior paramours, and then he says he wants to rape the prior paramours. So in this particular case, as the defense or the appellant argues to you, lack of sufficiency of evidence for the intent to murder, lying in wait, we agree. And the compelling fact in this case is that there was no animosity between the victim and the defendant, Mr. Hall. Indeed, that wasn't what Mr. Hall was like, or Mr. Flynn was like. He was a very caring individual, by all accounts. It was undisputed and testified to by the defendant's wife at the time of trial who had had that affair with her. So the only reason, because at the very beginning when this murder took place and the police contacted his girlfriend, and remember his wife at trial, she states, volume 11, 2306, or that's when the defendant testified that he denies that there was any argument with his wife prior to him getting out of the car. Yet when the girlfriend was interviewed day after the murder, she says that they were arguing. Prior to her being called by me in front of the grand jury, she says, I'm not going to tell that. The detectives asked, what was the argument about? She goes, I'm not going to tell you. I'm going to be in the court tomorrow. I'll say it under oath. What does she say the next day at the grand jury? I don't remember what the argument was about. The reason why that changed and why it was so critical is everybody in that room at the end of the trial in this case knew what the argument was about. It was about that he was enraged that she had had a prior affair. And not only that, the state was fortunate enough to have it on video. The vast majority of the time that the defendant left that car, he tracks directly to the Caesars Forum shop and waits for one person. Now, the defendant testified that he was waiting for people that he might know to come out to get a ride home, which belied common sense and belied the facts. He had a cell phone. He had it on him. You can actually see in the videotape the cell phone open up and illuminates his face, and we track precisely at that time of the timestamp of the video the cell phone call that he makes. So that was absolutely belied by the record as to the that he was just trying to cool off in his drunken rage. The other aspect of the robbery, very small point, and I apologize, we did not catch this in our response to the brief, but one of the compelling things of that video is this murder took place for almost 30 minutes. And as the defendant is walking quite a distance from the murder scene, which is off camera, he walks east towards Las Vegas Boulevard. And as he's walking up the sidewalk, all of a sudden he makes a direct left-hand turn and goes into the bushes. Detective Mogg testified at trial that he actually walked that exact path the day the body was discovered, the next morning. And when he go back into the bushes, they found a blood-stained dollar bill with Brad Flynn's blood DNA matched to it. So the evidence of the robbery was in the exact area of where the defendant walked and attempted to eliminate at least part of the funds that he had taken from this waiter who just got off shift. The other issue that I believe is relevant to the court's consideration, although not argued much here today, is the claim at page 23 of the opening brief, lines 18 to 25, where they talk about Mr. Hall's attempt to kill a more powerful opponent, and they claim Mr. Flam was much larger than Mr. Hall. If you look at the photographs of the two individuals, Mr. Flam at autopsy or in the still photograph taken just before he's murdered, literally probably 2 minutes before he's murdered, he's walking out of the back of Trevi and the camera catches him as he leaves. He's a very slight man. He may have been over 6 foot, but when you look at the still photograph captured of the defendant carrying the river rock back after he's slit his throat and several other acts, Mr. Hall is an extremely muscular, powerful individual. And as he testified as to this event, that altercation physically wasn't a struggle. It was one-sided. And it happened quickly, and it was violent. There was no evidence to answer the justice's question about the timing of the injuries. Blunt force trauma. Mr. Flam was killed basically four different ways. He was cut ear to ear via an incised wound four times, at least four across his neck. He had a 5-gallon paint can slammed on his head. His head, by the defendant's own testimony, was also slammed into a concrete slab. And then he went and got probably a large volleyball-sized river rock, and then that was used to pound his skull, which I think also speaks to the torture and mutilation about it. And to answer your justice's question is that there was no way a forensic pathologist, either in this case or I believe anyway, anyone assessing this case could determine the sequencing of that. I think the only sequencing that could be determined was the initial blows, where Detective Mogg testified to what appeared to be bloody nose type injuries that were drips perpendicular to the sidewalk, but then clearly the massive bloodletting event occurred some distance away, all at really low level, indicating that the victim was prone. There was some indication of arterial spray. I would suggest that that would indicate certainly that a heartbeat was occurring at least during the throat-slitting events. In addition, the jury instruction about citing to the Watson case, I believe under Watson, the term moral culpability is what that case was wrestling with. That language was not and the appellate briefs argued in this particular case, because I don't think that language was used. The objection is to mitigation relative to the offense. That was one out of two instructions. And instruction number 9 says the standard instruction approved by this court that mitigation is to any and all evidence, not that confined to either the offense or anything else. And I would note at appellate record 12, 25, 81, and 82, the jury verdicts in this case by the finding of mitigation found nine mitigators. All nine of the mitigators found in this case were outside of the event. And so even if any argument is lent that that language was somehow unduly restrictive, the jury indeed followed, as this court has opined in the past, that they follow all the instructions because indeed they found mitigation outside of the attended act itself. Unless the court had any other specific questions, that would conclude my presentation, and I appreciate the time.
Any questions? All right, thank you, Mr. Stanton. Ms. Feliciano, I'm going to give you some of Mr. Stanton's time. We'll increase your time to 5 minutes. And
thank you very much, Your
Honor. Sure.
Court's brief indulgence. I want to address first the state's argument that the psychiatric reports were not introduced into evidence to show future dangerousness, and that the state introduced them to show a nexus to the original crime and the true motive in this case. And the state has argued on appeal that this was merely historical evidence. And Justice Pickering, this is where I find that we come to a difference without a distinction. That they're saying historical evidence, that in fact it is evidence of future dangerous and a back way into that. At the penalty hearing, and this is in the record, pages 2619, 3092 through 3014, 3101 and 02, the state's investigator presented voluminous evidence regarding Mr. Hall's juvenile offenses and his confidential psychiatric evaluations. During the state's closing argument, the state read portions of the psychological evaluations in its closing argument to the jury. As I said, on appeal, the state argues that these are merely historical information about Hall, but the fact is the jury did hear the inflammatory testimony through its investigator regarding these confidential psychiatric evaluations. And so I submit that the state's argument that this is different from Redmond and Green, or that somehow this is a distinctive situation, is disingenuous. The second thing I would like to address, and if I can just add on that, I apologize. The state says that this was to show the opinion that Mr. Hall was a sexual sadist, and that this was the nexus, and that he needed counseling and had been deflecting his behavior and needed to become a productive member of society. And at the time that this was discussed, he was 14 years old. And so I do not submit that there is a sufficient nexus to overcome the prejudicial effect.
But doesn't his violent criminal behavior after this fact kind of negate that? You know, there's this pattern of behavior years later and as an adult that negates the prejudice that would have occurred by the introduction of that evidence?
Respectfully, I would disagree. I would disagree on a few grounds. First of all, Redmond and Green have recognized that the psychological evaluations prepared for the purposes of a penalty hearing are inadmissible. I think that that standard is far heightened when we're talking about juveniles in a juvenile system with juvenile adjudications and reports prepared confidentially, and with the juvenile not being instructed that they could be used against them at a later date.
Why couldn't the violence that was demonstrated much later be an independent basis for demonstrating future dangerousness to society?
The violence that occurred later, that occurred after he was an adult, was years after these reports were prepared.
Correct.
And I do not, a juvenile at that time, at 14 years old, has a very different brain than an adult does. An adult male does not completely form the frontal lobe or decide behavior, be able to rationally think things through until they're 21 or 22 years old. So to look at a 14-year-old brain and to say that, you know, this is going to be indicative of future crime and that the jury should then be allowed to look back to this situation and look back.
Am I wrong, though, Ms. Feliciano? I didn't understand that to be the argument on appeal. I understood the argument on appeal was the improper use of the evaluations themselves.
Yes.
As opposed to the separate issue, are acts committed by a juvenile something that's admissible in the penalty phase?
And what I will address, Your Honor, is...
Would you agree with me that, I mean, which is your argument, or are you making both in the briefs?
In the briefs, I believe that it was referenced, not directly referenced to, but implicit. And what I'm responding to is the state's argument on rebuttal that, the state's argument that this was not posted up in the appeal.
Uh-huh.
And the reason that it was not posted up in the appeal is based on the timeline. Initially, before the opening brief was filed, this court had decided the Brian Clay opinion. The Brian Clay opinion was then removed prior to the appellate's opening brief being filed. And the Brian Clay case was, this court asked for further briefing, further litigation. And so in response to that, because that issue was pending at the time, and to respond to the state's argument that it was not posted on appeal, it's because of the fluctuation of the case law on that issue. And that is my response, as well as contradicting the state's argument that this is merely historical evidence and not that that it is not evidence of future dangerousness.
Do you have the handy, I'm looking at the papers you've got there on the desk, do you have handy the record site on the investigator's reading of the psychological evaluations?
Yes, I do, Your Honor.
Okay.
Court's indulgence? The investigator, volume 12, 2619, volume 14, 3092 through 3014, and volume 14, 3101 through 02. And I believe that would also include the state's argument regarding the psychological records that it used in its closing and the reading by the state of the psychological evaluations to the jury during its argument in the penalty phase.
Okay. Thank you. I think that covers the time you have remaining. Are there any questions for Ms. Feliciano?
No.
All right, then we will be at recess. Thank you both, counsel, for your excellent arguments and briefing. It's good to see Mr. Stanton and Ms. Feliciano.
Be honest.